Bienvenue sur Radio Créum. Welcome to Radio Créum. This is a special recording of the Breaking the Silence Conference on the Indian Residential Schools Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada that took place at the University of Montreal on September 26th and 27th in 2008. You will now hear part two of the recording, which features the first panel chaired by Peter Deitch on Reconciliation, an International Perspective, with Jeff Korntassel, Paige Arthur, and Cynthia Milton.
J'ai le plaisir de vous présenter notre premier intervenant. Jeff Korntassel is Tsalagi, a member of the Cherokee Nation, and received his PhD from the University of Arizona. He's currently professor in the School of Indigenous Governance at the University of Victoria. Jeff was the first to represent the Cherokee Nation as a delegate to the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous Peoples, and we're very happy to have him here with us today. Jeff.
Osio, Doija, Selezitsa, Dakwado, Chi Jalagi. So my name is Jeff Korntassel, and it's a real pleasure to be here on Mohawk territory. So I want to acknowledge that I'm a visitor to this territory, and really appreciated the words of welcome from Delbert earlier, and the prayers. So wanted to talk a little bit about some international perspectives, but I think in getting to that, inevitably, I have to talk a little bit about a sort of a Shalagi approach, a Cherokee approach to reconciliation, and how that grounds some of my thinking as I go and look at some of the comparative international approaches that I'll share with you today. And in a sense, you know, we come up with the question at this conference of what does justice look like? And as we start to engage in that question in initiating some form of truth-telling, we really have to bring accounts of genocide to the forefront. And it's bringing these accounts of genocide to the forefront of settler consciousness, the consciousness of the people in this state that we know as Canada. And yet we know, as the first speaker, as Professor Gonzalez pointed out, just raising this consciousness, just telling these truths is not enough. It's part of a larger process. And so really what my talk is really going to focus on is what is this process, how has this process played out in other countries, and what is this process, how might this process look in the context of Canada with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Ultimately, truth-telling compels some sort of action, right? So truth-telling in that sense is just the first part of the step towards what I would describe as restitution, and focuses on justice for Indigenous peoples. Cherokees have a word for this, junohistodi, which means a process of renewing the relationship. And this is the way I approach questions of reconciliation. Junohistodi. It's a process, but it's about making a real renewal. It's a commitment towards a renewal of this relationship. And as the speaker pointed out today, this is the challenge we're up against. This is the challenge we're up against regarding the status quo, regarding transforming these relationships that have been colonial and continue to be colonial. It's part of a larger process. So without restructuring Indigenous-Canadian relationships, this is nothing more, in my mind, than a rhetorical reconciliation. It's nothing more than just us speaking about it without actually compelling some sort of action towards making things right again. As Professor Gonzalez pointed out, we've got he took away most of my good points, by the way, so so you'll be referring to him. We've got to go beyond the narrow parameters of the Truth and Reconciliation mandate and focus on questions of justice and larger issues of restitution. These rights, these notions of Indigenous self-determination are all bound together. We can't compartmentalize them. We can't take one out without discussing the other. And we can't talk about individuals without talking about our communities. And these are some of the lessons that I found in my research with Cindy Holder at the University of Victoria, and as well as others, have found when we've looked at truth commissions and their implementation of notions of reconciliation in the past. So if there's no justice without meaningful restitution, or there's no reconciliation without forms of restitution, what are we talking about? Well, I think a story is appropriate here. It's a story by Reverend Mpumbambi, and it illustrates the emphasis that's often placed on forgiving versus a process of rectifying the injustices that were caused. There were two friends, Peter and John. One day, Peter steals John's bicycle. Then, after a period of several years, he goes up to John with outstretched hands and said, "Let's talk about reconciliation." John says, "No, let's talk about my bicycle." "Forget about the bicycle for now," says Peter. "Let's talk about reconciliation." "No," says John, "we cannot talk about reconciliation until you return my bicycle." We have to have something substantive here. We have to talk about the real issues relating to indigenous territories that have been stolen. We have to talk about real issues of justice. And we can't separate them out. Otherwise, the notion or even a dialogue of reconciliation is not substantive. Without restitution, we are simply giving new life to the colonial project and permanently enshrining colonial injustices. It's about restoring ourselves as peoples, as indigenous peoples, spiritually, in terms of our ties to the land. It's about our livelihoods. It's about restoring ourselves socially and economically. It's about all these things. And so in that sense, it's difficult to speak just to one aspect of this, because we're talking about a larger process of colonialism that's being confronted here. To give you a sense of how I would counter that story of Peter and John, there's a Shalagi story of Selu and Ganati, and the corn mother and the hunter. And a lot of indigenous peoples have their own stories, their own, and I think we're going to hear from other panelists about the stories that people will share about their own teachings in terms of justice, in terms of reconciliation. And we may not refer to them in quite the same way, right? Junohis Dodi, right? But these have the same meaning. They have a similar impact in terms of community. And I think they also point out to the need to be culturally relevant, right, in this process. It has to be culturally relevant to communities, not just to individuals who are parts of those communities. The story, I'm not a good storyteller, so I'll give you the briefer version of it, but the story of Selu and Ganati talks about basically the corn mother and the hunter who have a child. And they have this child, and they decide this child is lonely, so he needs a brother. And at some point, the brother comes out of the river when the corn mother is cleaning the meat and comes out of the blood of that river. And this child is mischievous. And he starts to wonder how the corn mother is putting food on the table every night. And so he urges the other brother to go, and we'll sneak up on her and see where she gets this corn. She always goes away. And he finds that the corn mother goes to rub her thighs, and the corn comes from her body. He tells his brother, this is not normal. This is not something that she should be doing. So we need to take her life. We need to kill her. So they ambush their mother, and they take her life. When Kanati comes back, the hunter comes back and sees what they've done, he's horrified. He has to leave. He has to leave them. And basically, the corn mother, before she dies, she urges them to drag her body around the house 7 times. From the blood where they dragged her body around, this is kind of a bloody story, where they drag her body around, that's where the corn grows. Now, you might be saying, I can see the puzzled looks on your faces. You say, what does this have to do with reconciliation? And there are some deeper meanings to this story about renewing our roles and responsibilities. In order for Cherokees to have corn today, we have to remember this story. And we also have to make things right again with the corn mother, with Selu. and we have to make things right with Ganati. So it's a having a long memory about how Cherokees got corn and how that corn is a sacred part of our lives, and also what was done to make these wrongs that these children did to their mother, what was done to make these things right again. And we're still doing that. We're still trying to make things right again. So that tells you this is a long process. And Cherokees have a saying, learn to live in a longer now. Know your history and know that that's part of who you are now. And so oftentimes I hear in reconciliation, Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, there's also, and even apologies, there's a reference to turning a page and turning a new chapter in history. We don't really turn chapters, right? They're all part of the same chapter, in a sense. They're all part of the same notion of our shared memory and our shared history. Well, what have we found sort of internationally that gives us some insight into reconciliation and processes of restorative justice? What Cindy Holder and I found, and I think Professor Gonzalez has already pointed this out, so like I said, he took all my good points, but we looked at truth commissions in Guatemala and Peru, as well as some of the apologies and the reconciliation processes that took place in Australia and have taken place to date in Canada. What we found is that overall, these commissions overlooked meaningful restitution and focused on unification of the country to the exclusion of discussions of indigenous justice. There's also a focus on this is an effort for forgiveness, in the sense imposing forgiveness versus discussing these notions of justice and what indigenous justice might look like. The educative functions of a lot of these truth commissions also superseded a dialogue on justice. In a sense, it points out the challenges that we have in terms of needing to be innovative when it comes to the mandate of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and focus, maintaining a focus on renewing the relationships, maintaining that focus. It's on a process that's much longer term than a 5-year mandate. It's on a process that's much longer term than the last 500 years. It's part of a larger process. So this is not a one-time event. This is not a narrow focus on one particular issue, such as survival of residential schools. This is part of a larger context in the society, the colonial society, that we live. What are some of the global consequences or global perspectives? Well, here I rely on a lot on the work of Damien Short, who's done some really good work on reconciliation and examining that in Australia. And he has a book out, I think, as well. Looking at the stolen generations in Australia, where over 100,000 Indigenous children were taken from their homes and taken to schools and taken to new homes. It started in the 1980s, but in 1991, there was something called the Council for Australian Reconciliation that was developed. And this project was designed to some measure, approach this notion of what reconciliation would look like for Australia. One of the mandates was to set out to unite Australia, and it was also to educate folks about the implications and the legacies of the stolen generations. However, there was also a prime minister named John Howard who took power during this time, during the 1990s. And John Howard's view, I think, is indicative of a lot of views on the notion of reconciliation and even apologies and restitution. Howard basically said at one point, and this is why he refused ultimately to make a formal apology to Indigenous peoples in Australia, that current generations shouldn't be held accountable for the previous generation's wrongs or harms. Current generations should not be held accountable. And I think when you delve more deeply into this statement, you see that what it really masks is the privilege and the benefits that settler populations have received at the hands of Indigenous peoples. That is, Canada is what it is today because of its colonialism, because of its theft of land from Indigenous peoples. And in that sense, you can't ignore the past, and you can't segment the past to a certain time period that is convenient for study. You can't make it discrete. We have to look at a much larger notion of the past. We also have to look at a much larger notion of what cultural reconciliation means from an Indigenous perspective. Ultimately, what Damien Short finds in the short-lived term of the Council for Australian Reconciliation is that the emphasis on forgiveness won out over justice. And even more tellingly, the accounts of Indigenous women were marginalized throughout this process. So this is something to take heed in terms of the current process. There's a need to ensure that the struggles are not merely for the edification of settler Canadians, that it's not merely that these stories are being used, these accounts are being used for the edification of others. They have to be meaningful in the sense that they're moving towards a common goal, towards a notion of justice. It's a danger of appropriating history to focus on forgiveness and guilt versus a sharing history of transforming a relationship. As a result, Indigenous peoples are still mobilizing in Australia, and they continue to mobilize in Canada, to complete the unfinished business of reconciliation. So this mobilization continues with or without a reconciliation commission. It's not to say, as we learned from some of the earlier remarks, that we should disregard these important features of truth and reconciliation and separate ourselves. It's about taking hold of it and maybe transforming it, taking shape and taking ownership in the process so that it has much more meaning. How are we doing on time? Doing okay. Okay. I think another instructive case is from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And, you know, there have been several cases that have come up relating to reparations and restitution through this agency. And the one that I think is the most telling, especially for our discussion here, is the massacre of Plan de Sanchez versus Guatemala, and eventually ruled on in 2004. This is a massacre of 268 Mayan Achi people by the government of Guatemala in 1982. And the question became, before the Inter-American Commission, what about the cultural transmission of this knowledge to future generations? These 268 people have been silenced, and as a result, subsequent generations have been affected by this harm. They've been affected by the lack of transmission of oral histories, by the transmission of the language. And in a sense, how do we put a price on that? How do we begin to understand what restitution would mean in that context? Nevertheless, even though I think the outcome was well-intentioned, it was flawed, and we know that by looking at a lot of these events, well-intentioned but flawed. The court found, or the commission found, that cultural transmission of knowledge was interrupted to subsequent generations, and they sought a restitution measure that would help correct that. They found the state to be responsible for this. So the state was now responsible for facilitating, through money, through other avenues, some sort of cultural training within that community. Again, I think it's imperfect, but it gives us some ideas, perhaps some inspiration for discussing this. It was an attempt to rebuild that communication that had been lost intergenerationally. And I think that's the other part of this Truth and Reconciliation Commission that gets lost in the discussion, is that the intergenerational effects aren't being looked at. We're looking solely at what we think of as the people that attended these schools, the victims. But the victims are subsequent generations as well who are part of these families. And so how do we gauge what justice means from that perspective? And how do we gauge what justice is from the perspective of that community, which has been severely impacted by these people that have been taken from their community, and in some cases never making it back to that community. Their lives have been taken. Their cultures have been stripped. Another document we're talking about is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was ratified in 2007, despite the objection of Canada, the US, Australia, and New Zealand. And again, I think if we're going to look at responsibility and, I guess, the extension of actions from words, why did Canada see fit to challenge that and to oppose the ratification of this document, which is ultimately non-binding under international law? And Canada has their own official statements. You could read it online. But I think it's instructive to look at Articles 11, for example, future, and you could look these up. I won't recount them all. Articles 11, future manifestations of their cultures for Indigenous peoples. The state shall provide redress through effective mechanisms, which may include restitution developed in conjunction with Indigenous peoples with respect to their cultural, intellectual, religious, and spiritual property taken without their free, prior, and informed consent in violation of their laws, tradition, and customs. And I think the key here is free, prior, and informed consent. And what does that process look like? Not only from a notion of restitution, but also a notion of reconciliation. What does free, prior, and informed consent mean in the context of Canada? Article 22, special attention needs to be directed to Indigenous elders, women, and youth, and children, as should the TRC in this current context. This is where the focus should be, and oftentimes in previous truth commissions has been overlooked. And I think finally, Article 28 talks more specifically about the right to redress, including restitution, and it outlines some of the specifics on that. Another UN resolution that I think is instructive is UN Resolution 6147 of 2006, Guidelines on the Right to a Remedy and Reparation for Victims of Gross Violations of International Human Rights Law. And I'll read just a part of it, part of the mandate of this, but it's setting out guidelines, much like the Declaration is setting out on Indigenous peoples is setting out guidelines. The goal: restore the victim to the original situation before the gross violations of international human rights law or serious violations of international humanitarian law occurred. Restitution includes, as appropriate, restoration of liberty, enjoyment of human rights, identity, family life, and citizenship, return to one's place of residence, restoration of employment, and return of property. Now, that's not enough in the sense that what does satisfaction entail? What does it mean to actually satisfy those criteria? Well, they lay out several, and I'll just read out a couple. Effective measures aimed at the cessation of continuing violations, verification of the facts and full and public disclosure of the truth, which is what we're talking about here, the search for the whereabouts of the disappeared, in accordance, and I think what's important about that is in accordance with the expressed or presumed wish of the victims or the cultural practices of the families and communities. An official declaration or judicial decision restoring the dignity, the reputation, and the rights of the victim. A public apology, including acknowledgments of the facts and acceptance of responsibility. Judicial and administrative sanctions against persons liable for the violations. Commemorations and tributes to the victims. Inclusion of an accurate account of the violations that occurred in international human rights law and international humanitarian law training and in educational materials at all levels. Now, that sounds pretty exhaustive, but being a political scientist, you know, I always find loopholes. And I found that it was lacking in several areas, and I think that are maybe things to consider. I pose them more as questions. Four different things that it seems to be lacking, even though it's fairly comprehensive. Does the reconciliation process follow the protocols on the Indigenous communities participating? Is it an appropriate way of pursuing justice? Second, is there a recognition of the harm caused to contemporary communities and not just to individual victims? Third, is Indigenous self-determination affirmed by this process of reconciliation and ultimately restitution? And fourth, to what degree is this process restructuring the Indigenous state relationship? To what degree is it renewing the relationship that we've talked about? Well, I'll conclude here since I'm running out of time. But after reflecting on some of the global efforts to confront reconciliation, as well as the story of Selu and Kanati, I pose a question. Our settler societies, indigenous people sharing a common vision for how to make amends and how to engage in a genuine process of reconciliation. To what degree do we share similar views on this? And where we don't share these views, to what degree are we renewing that relationship? To what degree are we trying to understand and comprehend the gaps? Because we know that truth-telling on its own is not going to reach that notion of reconciliation. It's got to be bridged by other things. It's got to be bridged by notions of restitution. It's got to be bridged by notions of self-determination. And so truth-telling and reconciliation still have to come together in some way in this process. And I'm thinking it is a long-term process, as was pointed out earlier. So the answer to this question is really part of our challenge, a challenge to make the process culturally relevant to Indigenous nations as well as to individuals. And I think the answer will really determine our next steps towards Juno Zidido, this notion of renewing the relationship, the process of renewing the relationship. So, Wado, thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff Korntassel. We now turn to our second speaker, Paige Arthur, who is Deputy Director of Research at the International Center for Transitional Justice, where she's running a long-term research project in identity politics and transitional justice. She holds a PhD in history from the University of California, Berkeley, and she's a specialist in European decolonization and its aftermath. She has written on issues related to political violence and identity politics. She was also the senior program officer of the Ethics in a Violent World initiative at the Carnegie Council. And in that sense, she's someone with experience in both academia and practice at the level of international organizations. We're very glad to have her with us today. Please.
Thanks very much. And thanks to Jeff, actually, for those really wonderful stories that you were sharing with us. I want to organize my talk today around three different questions. And the first is going to be, what is the relationship between a truth-telling process and reconciliation? The second is, what role do identities play in truth-telling and reconciliation? And the third is the all-important question that has been faced by truth commissions around the world. How do you engage the unengaged in a truth-telling process, like a truth commission? And I'm actually also going to organize my presentation around some political cartoons that are from a cartoonist in South Africa. His name is Jonathan Shapiro. He goes by the name Zapiro. And I'll show you the first. And he's just a trenchant cultural critic. He did political cartoons throughout the life of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I think they're relevant to our discussions today. So the South African TRC captured imaginations around the world, and its perceived success in gaining recognition for human rights violations under apartheid and also in the transition away from apartheid, because both periods were included, may in fact be one of the reasons why Canada, among many other countries, has contemplated and then now decided to implement a truth commission on the residential schools. Now, the South African Truth Commission, as you probably know, operated from 1995 to 1998. It started hearings in 1996. More than 22,000 South Africans gave statements to the Truth Commission. There is the controversial provision where amnesty could be exchanged for full disclosure of politically motivated human rights violations. Eduardo talked about this briefly. 9,000 South Africans applied under that provision. Less than 400 were actually deemed to have satisfied the conditions for amnesty. So that's just the basic background in the South African TRC. And I think what this cartoon shows is you see Desmond Tutu there with a map. You see a victim, a perpetrator. You see the masses of the media behind them. And they're on the side of truth. And they realize, well, how do we get to reconciliation? What's that relationship? So as the cartoon suggests, South Africans themselves noticed a critical problem. And this brings me to my first question of what is the relationship between truth and reconciliation? Does one lead inexorably to the other, or is a leap of faith necessary? And answering these questions requires both theoretical reflection and also, I think, some empirical research. And I'll begin with just some brief theoretical reflection on the idea that one needs a theory before one can test it empirically. The general aims of a truth commission are to find out facts about past abuses, to counter official state narratives, which may be deliberately misleading or may be outright lies, to give victims and survivors a chance to tell their stories, and to better understand the role of the state and social institutions in aiding and abetting abuse. But why does a truth commission try to achieve these goals? Well, there are a number of reasons. One is to reduce the range of permissible lies. This is a famous phrase from Michael Ignatieff, who you know quite well up here. Another aim is to change narratives. That is, the stories in which facts are embedded. So it's not just about facts, it's about the narratives themselves. To validate victims' experiences publicly, to legitimize the grievances that may have been ignored publicly, and also, importantly, to facilitate institutional change. Now, of course, truth commissions typically aren't responsible for implementing institutional change themselves. They typically operate on the discursive level, the level of public debate, and the idea that that it's part of the process of generating political will necessary to transform institutions that are responsible for the abuses. So we can see very clearly how achieving these goals might be considered beneficial for victims, but do they promote reconciliation? And I think it depends on what you think reconciliation means. For some, reconciliation is thought of in political terms, the creation or recreation of bonds of trust between citizens and a state, as well as among citizens. And if this is your goal, then certainly you'd be interested in the ways that truth-telling or an official truth commission can transform victimized groups' relationship both to the state and to their fellow citizens. For others, reconciliation refers more to achieving trust specifically among groups or across groups, usually defined on the basis of identity, ethnicity, race, religion, etc. And this tends to be the definition of, for example, conflict resolution specialists, people working in the peace-building field. For still some others, reconciliation refers to interpersonal relationships in which reconciliation occurs between a perpetrator and a victim. I think actually Eduardo talked about this notion of reconciliation in his talk. This is often done under the initiative of religious leaders or traditional authority figures. It might be part of an ADR process. It's more of a restorative justice approach. And then actually following Jeff, I want to mention a fourth conception of reconciliation, which is reconciliation as a process of decolonization, transforming colonial relationships. And you'll see with these different conceptions of reconciliation that some of them are more robust than others, and some imply more social transformation than others. All right, so what happened in South Africa? And here I want to turn to the empirical side. Reconciliation was and is a fraught term in South Africa. It was often laden with Christian overtones of forgiveness that resonated with some people and turned other people off. The idea that public staged encounters between victims and perpetrators in which one apologized and the other forgave could have a healing effect has been heavily criticized, although it's still something that's practiced. I actually was just in Northern Ireland a couple months ago, and people there were talking about a television program that Desmond Tutu had done in Northern Ireland where he brought together a Catholic Republican victim with a Protestant loyalist perpetrator in a television program and staged sort of a moment of a forgiveness between them. So it is still something that's widely practiced. I have to say, though, that I'm in agreement with Eduardo that this is not the kind of reconciliation that I believe is achievable or appropriate to an official truth commission itself. Although I think we could see it working as a corollary with community-led initiatives, and this has certainly been the case in some countries around the world. For example, East Timor, where traditional rituals were incorporated as part of a truth-telling process, but not a substitute for an official process. On the other hand, one could ask whether the public debate unleashed by the South African TRC changed beliefs and behaviors with respect to the state, as well as beliefs and behaviors with respect to other groups. And here there has been some research done on the question. I'd like to cite the work of James Gibson, who's an American researcher who has been studying the effects of the South African TRC for many, many years. And his research is based on qualitative surveys with thousands of South Africans. And Gibson is trying to measure two things in the South African case. First, the degree to which South Africans accepted the narrative promulgated by the TRC. That is, the TRC's conclusions that apartheid was a crime against humanity and that all sides in the struggle committed gross human rights violations. And this is his measurement of truth. And then second, he tried to measure the degree to which people rejected interracial stereotypes, the degree to which they had high levels of political tolerance, or tolerance for diverse political opinions or views, the degree to which they supported human rights principles, and the level of legitimacy of the new post-apartheid state. And this is his very complex and multifaceted measure of reconciliation. And note that it sort of combines some of the definitions of reconciliation that I mentioned before. What Gibson found was that acceptance of the truth of the TRC's findings correlated with this measure of reconciliation among many of the four, it did correlate with all of the four quote-unquote racial groups in South Africa, Africans, whites, colored people, and people of Asian origin, although it correlated most strongly with members of the black and the white group. And he found quite decisively that accepting the truth promulgated by the TRC did not undermine reconciliation. There was not a negative correlation for any of the groups. So what theory did he provide to account for this correlation between truth and reconciliation? Well, Gibson suggests that the TRC succeeded in getting people to rethink their views about the struggle over apartheid by creating cognitive dissonance and mitigating dogmatism. And this resulted in changes in the way South Africans feel about one another. In short, the truth and reconciliation process created uncertainty and doubt about the goodness and the morality of one's own cause. And I was struck by the sort of irony of his finding that truth works through creating doubt and through creating uncertainty. And his idea was that through creating doubt and uncertainty, people begin to share responsibility, they begin to share blame, victimhood, and that this sharing can break down divisive identities and can provide a basis for dialogue. People are no longer dogmatically attached to a good versus evil narrative, and as a result, a space for reconciliation is open. So, how do we jump from one side of the abyss to the other? by changing the terms of public debate, by shifting people's beliefs and behaviors about crimes of the past. It's a very tall order, especially when there are entrenched prejudices and myths animating beliefs about different groups, and that's the reason why the abyss is so wide. So now I'm going to turn to my second cartoon. And this is a depiction of the Rainbow Nation, a term made famous by Nelson Mandela during the South African transition. And you see at one end of the rainbow a black South African reading a newspaper with the headline of TRC revelations. And at the other end of the rainbow, a white person, a white South African, sort of looking, they're both looking suspiciously at each other. One of them's watching soccer, the other's watching rugby. And the government in Pretoria has no idea how to connect the dots, bring these two groups together. So many of you will, of course, be familiar with the idea of a rainbow nation or a multicultural nation. And presumably, such a nation with the dots connected would be one outcome of a reconciliation process. This is an especially salient idea here in Canada, which is a settler nation, and in which Indigenous groups themselves have claimed to sovereignty and nationhood. And I think that one of the issues of this conference actually is about is what connecting the dots actually would mean in Canada. What are the desired structural relationships? And this is an issue that Jeff was touching on in his talk. Now, often it goes without saying that members of different identity groups may have strongly divergent perceptions about what reconciliation means or what it might entail. And in fact, one of our conference organizers, Paulette Regan, has written very eloquently on this subject here in Canada. We find this in the US in the debate over reparations for slavery. We also find it in Guatemala, where the Ladino-led government refused to acknowledge the finding of genocide on the part of the Historical Clarification Commission. So I turn to my second question. What role do identities play in truth-telling and reconciliation? And here I'd like to move away from South Africa and to the Balkans, since we're talking about international perspectives. Now, let us start by acknowledging that identities play various roles in the lives of individuals and in communities, both positive and negative. And I'm going to focus on some of the negative aspects for reconciliation here, but I would be interested in hearing comments on the positive aspects for reconciliation in the discussion that follows. And one example is the role that traditional religious rituals can potentially play in processes of reconciliation, which I've talked about previously. One role that identities play, and which is highlighted in the Balkans case very sharply, is that they may foster a competition or a hierarchy of victimhood. So the idea that Serbs are historical victims from the Battle of Kosovo to World War II to the conflict in the 1990s is an important feature of the Serb identity promoted by nationalists, by Serb nationalists. And it's prevented an adequate reckoning with the deeds of Serb leaders and military commanders who have shrouded their actions in a cloak of self-defense of the community, self-defense of the nation. So actual victims of the wars in the 1990s are discounted in favor of historical victimhood of the Serb people. And these are ideas that are reinforced by these powerful nationalist leaders and also by the media, which is largely under the thumb of these groups. But we can see competition for victimhood in other instances. And I'm thinking here, I actually was just in northern Iraq last week, where the Kurdish people, who have de facto independence, are trying to gain reparations for genocide of the Kurds under the regime of Saddam Hussein. And they sent a draft reparations law to the Iraqi parliament, and it was rejected essentially through criticism of groups from the south, Shiites, who say, we also suffered under the regime of Saddam Hussein. Why should you get reparations when we're not getting reparations? But you also see competition within groups, when supposedly homogenous groups break apart. And I mean, an example is Guatemala, where there's a very strong pan-Maya movement, but we know, of course, that not all indigenous people in Guatemala are Maya. How does this competition affect truth-telling and reconciliation? For me, it makes it more difficult to arrive at truths that all groups can accept and internalize. The idea of a one narrative along the lines of the South African model may be unworkable. And the best that can be achieved is a mutual understanding and empathy towards the narrative of the other group. And this may be a sort of minimalist understanding of reconciliation. And it is perhaps what the idea of a multicultural nation implies as an outcome, although I think many people will criticize this as insufficient and not adequately robust. And how has this actually happened in the Balkans? I can give you one example. The truth-telling in the Balkans has largely emerged through trials and not through truth commission, because there has been no truth commission. There has been talks and proposals and ideas, all of which so far have failed. Many Serbs believe that judicial institutions, especially the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, are biased against them. And indeed, the courts serve to reinforce Serbs' own views of themselves as victims. They're now being victimized by the international community through these courts. And since they don't believe the ICTY to be fair or legitimate, it's easy for them to discount the facts that come out of the voluminous documents and testimonies that the court has generated. And this has included outright denial of the massacre that occurred at Srebrenica. The possibility for such denial changed literally overnight in 2005, when the ICTY released a really gruesome videotape showing an elite Bosnian Serb group called the Scorpions murdering unarmed captives from Srebrenica. And it's been widely acknowledged that the simple release of this video provoked a sea change in public consciousness of the massacre and responsibility for it. Now, did this revelation promote reconciliation? I don't know if it did in the short term, but I think it serves the ends of reconciliation. Survivors of the massacre have had their experience validated to some degree. The Serb-dominated entity in Bosnia, the Republika Srpska, has recognized the massacre and even convened a commission to address it. The resentment that Bosniaks may have felt towards Serbs who denied the wound, this resentment simply would have festered in the absence of the tape. Instead, perhaps it has lessened. And many Serbs who have come to reckon more honestly with some of the deeds supposedly undertaken in their name. Time. 4 minutes. Okay, I'm going to skip to the third slide. So I'm moving now to the question of engaging the unengaged. And here you have a great depiction of a white South African listening to the radio broadcast, perhaps, of public hearings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but not hearing what is said. And the words literally go in one ear and out the other. And the newspaper about the truth, with detailing the revelations of the TRC, is in the trash. So presumably, if the truths that are acknowledged during a truth-telling process simply go in one ear and out the other of the vast majority of the public, then we can hardly expect truth-telling to have an impact on reconciliation, which is the question we're dealing with here. And this is a question that many truth commissions have tackled with varying degrees of success. And although this cartoon depicts the indifference of white South African to the TRC revelations, I think James Gibson's work gives a bit more nuanced picture of that, in which some white South Africans did engage and did learn from it. So what are some of the ways to engage the unengaged so that they become part of the process rather than passive or hostile to it? One important way is that truth commissions should not serve to demonize whole groups, whether by design or by accident. Such an approach is sure to generate resentment and resistance, or indifference. I think there's a fine line there, because referring back to Gibson's truth commissions should create uncertainty or doubt about the rightness of one's own cause. So it shouldn't demonize, but it should create uncertainty. Beyond that, experiences in other countries have shown that outreach programs have to be established early. They must be adequately resourced with consistent, dedicated funding. And they have to consider creating different messages and different modes of outreach tailored to different target groups. And let me give you some examples here. Returning to the ICTY in Serbia, the ICTY established an outreach program in Serbia 6 years after the beginning of the tribunal's work. And in the intervening 6 years, an extraordinarily hostile and sophisticated media had propagated highly politicized and distorted stories about the court's work. And so by the time that the court realized that this had happened and was a problem, it was really almost too late to do anything to change public perceptions and the public messages are being received about the tribunals. Because, as journalists say, it's the first story that counts. This is why outreach has to be started early and it has to have dedicated resources. So facing these huge obstacles in Serbia, the ICTY outreach officer, Alexander Milanov, effectively wrote off the idea of engaging with adults. She said, it simply won't be possible with the resources I have. And as trite as it may sound, children are the future. That's going to be the focus of my work. And so she initiated programs and worked with local NGOs that were attempting to have youth talk to other youth about the work of the court. And indeed, educational outreach has been a dedicated focus of truth commissions in Peru as well as in Sierra Leone. And Sierra Leone actually created a cartoon version of its report to engage a broader public and also engage youth. Another ICTY outreach officer, Refik Hodzik, also engaged specifically with local NGOs and local community groups. He designed a program he called Bridging the Gap, where the tribunal's work in a particular case, let's say a case that dealt with a community in Belgrade, would be taken to, what he would do is he would engage with community groups in the affected area and then bring ICTY officials together to serve as a platform for communities to weigh the evidence for themselves and to discuss what had taken place among them during the war. And indeed, NGOs and community groups have a really special role to play in outreach. They can act as trusted mediators between the state and local groups. And here I think of just one final example, which is Northern Ireland, where there's been established under the police service a special group that's investigating every single political murder that took place during the time of the Troubles. And what they do is they generate a report about what happened that then goes to the families of victims. Well, one problem is that so much time has elapsed since these crimes took place that sometimes the families of the victims remember events very differently from the information that they're receiving in the reports. And because there's a traditional distrust on the part of Catholic Republican communities toward the police, which they see as an oppressive state apparatus, they will reject the findings of the report. And so there are NGOs that are working with this police group in order to sort of translate or talk over the results with victims' families. And sometimes they even take them to the scene of the crime and show them how it, in fact, did happen differently from what they remember. So it's this kind of activity where NGOs are really important as trusted mediators. At the same time, another example in the Balkans is that NGOs have been used to disseminate findings of the ICTY. And there was a program that was developed a few years back in which they initially were funded to help do that. And then after 6 months, the funding was pulled and they were asked to find their own funding. Well, the whole project fell apart. So again, it goes to stress the idea that there has to be dedicated funding and a real investment. Now, are there messages that would have reached this white South African? We can't know for sure, but we're learning more and more about strategies for doing so. And this involves being aware of messages that might generate resentment or hostility and employing different cultural cues and messages for different groups. In the end, however, some truths are simply hard truths that must be swallowed whole. And it's important to note that I'm not recommending that we water down the truth about abuse simply to engage the unengaged or to promote reconciliation, for that wouldn't be truth at all, and it wouldn't be a basis for reconciliation. But if we want to bridge the gap between these two, then I think it would be well worth considering some of the issues I've raised today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paige. As our final speaker of this first panel, it is my pleasure to introduce Cynthia Milton, who teaches Latin American history here at the University of Montreal. She holds the Canada Research Chair in Latin American History and is director of the Réseau d'études de l'Amérique latine. She received her PhD from the University of Madison, Wisconsin, and she recently published a book on colonial Ecuador and is co-editor of the book on the art of truth-telling about authoritarian rule. Cynthia.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'd also like to thank the coordinators of this event, and in particular, Martin Blanchard, for his hard efforts at bringing this together. My talk today is reconciling with the past, posed as a question, and I'm going to look specifically at Peru 5 years after they've had their truth commission. Unfortunately, some of the images aren't going to appear as I would like them because I'm a Mac user trying to make it work on a PC. Just a bit of background. I'm an historian, and my research principally is on how countries construct national narratives of past conflict through official mechanisms such as truth commissions, and what kinds of alternative truths and other modes for recounting truth are created in the wake of such official mechanisms, that being truth commissions. The focus of my research is on the Peruvian Truth Commission, known as the Comisión de Verdad y Reconciliación, which was launched in 2001 and had a 2-year mandate ending on August 28, 2003, when the commissioners submitted the final report to the then President of the Republic, Alejandro Toledo. It has been 5 years since the Truth Commission handed in its report, so I wish to look back on the impact of this report on the creation of a national narrative of the past and in terms of the possibility of reconciliation in Peru. I'm framing my assessment of this impact as a series of tensions of truth, truth, of course, in quotation marks. These tensions of truths are almost paradoxes. They're present, I believe, in TRCs and truth commissions in general, and there are also tensions of truth in the CVR in Peru in particular. I outline three possible tensions. This by no means is an exhaustive list. I then take from the Peruvian experience some possible points of interest for the Canadian Commission on Residential Schools. I wish to establish my point of departure about TRCs, and these ideas will already be familiar to many of you and with the presentations that precede me. At heart, TRCs are mechanisms for two distinct processes. TRCs aim to bring to light and to make part of a national official narrative or story the harm done to fellow citizens in the past, thus marking a clear distinction with the present. That is, truth-telling, the recounting of the past, is meant for the construction of a national narrative about a period of conflict that distances the present from this past. Secondly, many but not all truth commissions hope that by establishing the truth or truths of what happened, the path towards societal reconciliation will be easier to traverse, easier to get over that gap that the cartoon showed. Accordingly, the possibility of reconciliation is contingent upon knowing the past. Let me give a quick backdrop background to Peru. From 1980 to 1992, there was a civil war that had been launched by the Maoist insurgent group known as Shining Path, Sendero Luminoso. At the height of this war, some 30% of the Peruvian national territory was under a state of emergency and essentially under the control of the military, thus seriously compromising what was democratic rule in a weak state. Looking back at this time, and as Eduardo has presented, one can summarize the violence in the highlands for the highland peoples and communities as being caught between the violence of Shining Path and the violence of the state that sought to extinguish subversives. In 1992, Abimael Guzman, the head of the Shining Path, was captured, but the authoritarian style rule continued on until Alberto Fujimori, the president's resignation that he sent via fax from Japan in 2000. In the aftermath of the sudden collapse of the authoritarian state, an interim president, Valentin Paniagua, established a truth commission that was recognized, though modified, by the subsequently elected president, Alejandro Toledo. Toledo added members to the commission. He made it from 7 to 12 plus one observer on the commission. And he had altered the title and implicitly the aims of the commission. He changed the title from Truth Commission to Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In total, the CVR had a staff of over 800 people, collected almost 17,000 testimonies in Peru's 24 departments, with a focus on the areas most heavily affected by the violence that are indicated on this map here. The Truth Commission's mandate was to establish the development and facts of and responsibility for the acts of violence from 1980 to 2000. The commission hoped that their investigation and proposed initiatives would lead to, quote, affirming peace and agreement among Peruvians. The CVR held a broader mandate than other commissions. For instance, the CVR's scope was considerably wider than that of the Truth Commission held in Chile, known as the Rete Commission, which at the time could only investigate death and disappearance. In Peru, the Truth Commission investigated assassinations, kidnappings, disappearance, torture, and other serious wounds, violations of collective rights of Andean and Native communities, and other grave violations against people's rights. Even the much-acclaimed TRC in South Africa had a narrower focus, since it considered only gross human rights violations that were politically motivated, excluding the day-to-day violence committed by apartheid. Rather, the Peruvian Commission firmly placed the internal conflict of 1980 to 2000 as a period in a longer national history of racism and centralism that was both the cause and consequence of the violence. That is, in addition to determining the responsibility for abuses and violations, identify and report on the experiences of victims, develop proposals for reparations and reforms, the Peruvian Truth Commission mandate also analyzed the political, social, cultural, and historical context which contributed to the violence. That the Peruvian Truth Commission was able to structure a wider mandate than many other commissions has much to do with the historic moment when the Truth Commission came into existence. Other commissions emerged, as Eduardo has pointed out, from pacted transitions. That is, with a still menacing army and armed forces securing certain privileges upon their departure. In the case of Peru, it came from a political vacuum that was made by the sudden collapse of Fujimori's authoritarian regime. The Peruvian Truth Commission's final report came out in August of 2003, and it was staggering. Peru has a population size equivalent roughly to that of Canada. Some 69,000 people were dead or disappeared, over 43,000 orphans. There were some 600,000 internal refugees in the preceding years, 20 years of violence. The violence that was ignited by Shining Path and made worse by the armed forces' brutal, indiscriminate response was highlighted by the Truth Commission. The report found Shining Rapath responsible for 54% of the documented acts of violence and indicated the forces of order, which is a euphemism to denote the armed forces and police, responsible for over 35%. Almost every sector of the political elite came out dirty in this report. The political parties, groups within the Catholic Church, the armed forces, successive democratically elected governments, and the government of Fujimori. Three out of every four victims were non-Spanish speakers, mainly Quechua speakers from the Peruvian highlands. The regions hardest hit, again, were in the Peruvian highlands, small isolated communities, representing some 85% of the victims. Thus, the violence was heavily racialized, and within specific regions, far from the predominantly mestizo white population of the nation's capital, Lima, which is found on the coast of Peru. The president of the Truth Commission, Dr. Salomon Lerner, formerly a history professor at the Universidad Católica, in his address with the submission of the final report to the president of the Republic, Alejandro Toledo, called these years of violence, these 20 years of violence, a double scandal. The first scandal was the large-scale assassination, disappearance, and torture. And the second scandal, the indolence, ineptitude, and indifference among those who could have prevented this humanitarian catastrophe from happening. 5 years have passed now since the Peruvian Commission for Reconciliation and Truth and Reconciliation made public their report. Yet rather than taking the center stage of a national discussion about the past, the findings of the CVR are largely pushed to the fringe and kept alive by the work of a few governmental bodies, mainly the ombudsman, and the non-governmental organizations, despite the severities of the Truth Commission's findings. During my recent research trip to Peru this past August, the general sentiment in Peru seemed to me to be one of a small world of NGOs trying to defend the work of the CVR and to continue the uphill battle of disseminating the findings, despite governmental, military, and church officials who continue to speak out against the CVR, the Truth Commission, as though it still existed, and its report. But there is also the perspective of those affected by the violence who feel that little has changed since the report came out 5 years ago, who had hoped for more than the occasional symbolic reparation. This leads to the first truth tension that I wish to address, present in TRCs. The TRC is seen as at once indispensable for the marking the transition to a new form of government, for the knowing of the past now, but is also seen as insufficient in the short run. The expectations and needs are immediate, expectations for truth, for reparations, for reconciliation. TRCs then open a space for such demands and expectations, but they cannot meet them immediately. An example of the indispensability yet insufficiency of truth commissions are the many requests to find disappeared loved ones. The TRC opens the question of donde están, where are they, where are our disappeared loved ones, and makes asking such a question legitimate, whereas previously asking such a question might have placed one within the camp considered subversive. But the slow work of excavating mass graves makes finding the disappeared a distant possibility, if at all a possibility. Now we are 5 years later, and this is a very short period of time, 5 years. It is perhaps still too early to evaluate the impact of the Truth Commission in Peru. For instance, 5 years after the Truth Commission in Chile, Pinochet was still powerful. There were no trials. One could not have imagined the creation of a second national commission into torture and political imprisonment, which was established in 2003, let alone the election of Michelle Bachelet. That is, TRC should be considered a step in a much longer, larger process. They are a wedge that will continue to open up and widen fissures. This leads us to a second tension, thank you, Paige, of truth present in TRCs. Here I am borrowing a formulation from the historian Steve Stern. There are two kinds of truths, uses of truth for distinct ends. The first is TRCs being used as a political formula, and the second is TRCs being used as a wedge. The political formula is the following. We will establish the truth so that we can now close it and move on to other things. This is the tendency of the political elite. A good example of this is of this political formula is the cartoon drawn by an Argentine but for a Peruvian audience, where a cardinal asks, what are we going to do with the book Nunca Más, which is the final report for the Argentine Truth Commission? To which the banker asks, in order that it never happens again. And the military man, who looks strikingly like Pinochet, says, no, responds the military, so that we never again speak of the subject. This is in contrast to political, in contrast to the Truth Commission as a wedge, whereby NGOs and civil societies use the space created by the formation of a Truth Commission to push open other public spaces for the voicing of discontent and various interpretations of the past. This discontent can be directed specifically at the TRCs. For instance, TRCs in Peru was accused of being a lie commission, accused of being a waste of money. The truths that are told, that are divergent from truth commissions, might have a complement to truth commissions, but they might also express truths that fall outside of truth commissions, or that might go underreported, taboos, truths such as sexual violence, for instance. TRCs embolden people to seek out what happened by creating a public space and a legitimacy to this public space. It emboldens people to tell what happened, to ask what happened, and to demand justice and reform. The two uses of truth, truth as political formula and truth as wedge, play into each other. Without the political formula, then we wouldn't have the wedge. And without the pressure from NGOs and civil society, then elites would not have the political will to create the formula. How successful has the CVR been as a wedge then, 5 years after? There are important successes in post-CVR Peru. For instance, at the level of retributive justice, Fujimori has been sentenced for corruption charges and is in trial right now for his involvement in two massacres. Others have been jailed, and more than 1,000 cases are before the courts. A commission for reparations of victims is underway, establishing a list of people to receive individual reparations. Such things would have been unimaginable in Chile 5 years after their transition. Yet there are important limits to the wedge. Peru as a whole has yet to take on or assumir its past. In Peru, it is with great indifference that the political elites and limeños regard this past. That is, Salomon Lerner's remarks about the double scandal, half of that double scandal still remains, and that is indifference. Or to borrow from Page's presentation, the problem of how to make the unengaged engaged. When there are moments in which this past reaches a national discourse, such as the extradition of Alberto Fujimori, who is presently standing trial, the news of his extradition sparked a violent response. Thanks, Paige. The vandalism of one of the few memorials dedicated to those killed and disappeared during the internal war, El Ojo Que Llora, the eye that cried. It's a path of stones with the names, individual names of victims, the date of their death and their age, and carved into each stone. And the evening of news of Fujimori's extradition, some supposed Fujimoristas, supporters of Fujimori, they bound the guard and splashed orange paint over El Ojo Que Llora and broke some of the stones. At another event when Fujimori was being held accountable for the massacre or for the killing of students at the Kantuta University, the following day the names of those students were carved out with a pen in the El Ojo que Llora. The conflict over the eye that cries, this monument, is worrisome because it shows the continued use of violence to silence opposing truths. What then is the possibility of reconciliation within Peru in this context of indifference, but also with eruptions of violence? Reconciliation is a term with many possible definitions, many of which we've already heard today. Though the roots can be found in many different religious streams, I think that the meaning of reconciliation in Peru is largely one of living in nonviolence with each other, perpetrator, bystander, victim. This does not necessarily mean forgiveness, such as sought by Desmond Tutu in South Africa's TRC, nor does it mean impunity, as feared by many in Argentina, especially in the 1980s and 1990s. Nor does it mean necessitate remorse on the side of perpetrators, which is a difficult thing to expect after having read Lee Payne's recent study called Unsettling Accounts on Perpetrators' Confessions of Human Rights Abuse. Rather, I want to borrow from Judge Richard Goldstone. I think it was him who said this. And it's been stated and similarly expressed by Salomon Lerner for the Peruvian Truth Commission, and that is, the work of reconciliation is not necessarily between citizens, but between citizens and their past. This leads us to the last tension of truth that I wish to address, and that is reconciling with the past. One tension of reconciling with the past is how individual and community experiences are reflected in the emblematic memories established by the Truth Commissions. There's a tension between the truth at the macro national level and the micro level of communities and individuals. In Peru, the different truths at the different levels are quite striking. At the macro level, the narrative is that the peasant communities were caught between two fires, that of Shining Path and the state. At the micro level, there is much silence. Communities members may speak of an assaulted community, and this is perhaps the most accepted, readily accepted stance of victim within the macro narrative. They do not speak of internal visions, of internal conflict and violence, of gendered violence, of initial participation or sympathy with Shining Path. These are taboo truths that are silenced at the micro level. The macro truth tends to emphasize the two devils, Shining Path and the military. At the micro level tends to emphasize the indiscriminate violence of state agents. These micro truths are apparent in public performances. They're also apparent in song. If one were to do a study of, say, Pumpin in the highlands of Ayacucho, you would see these micro truths coming out. And they're also evident in artwork, which is one of the areas that I'm presently working. But these micro truths do not necessarily make it to the national narrative. So the tension is that micro truths do not find resonance in the macro truths of a nation. Thus, individual and community experience escape from the incomplete macro narrative, thus making reconciliation with the past difficult, if not at the very least incomplete. Reconciling with the past is made yet more difficult by the continued presence of the past in the present. The divisions within the multi-ethnic society that existed prior to the Civil War are still in place today. Racism, poverty, centralism of power in Lima, and the remoteness of the highlands and Amazonian regions. There is one area in reconciling the past with the past that the Peruvian Truth Commission has been uniquely successful, and Eduardo touched upon this during his presentation, and that was the formation of public hearings, the audiencias públicas. The public hearings were planned as a performative act in which commissioners could, quote, fulfill the Peruvian obligation to hear and make heard the victims. From these public hearings, the Truth Commission gathered over 400 testimonies that testified to over 300 cases of gross human rights violations. The public hearings were similar to that of South Africa in model, but with important differences. The perpetrators were absent. There was no amnesty granted, therefore. There was no contest over what was truth. The invited witnesses were considered representative cases for larger socio-political patterns of violence, and in principle, anyone with an identification card could attend. An important consequence of these public hearings was to give legitimacy to experiences that had previously been denied or ignored by state authorities, and establishing an official record of the violence committed. They also might have contributed, as Teresa Godwin Phelps has argued for the public hearings of South Africa, to the restoration of humanity and citizenship of individuals and communities harmed. By way of concluding, I wish to reflect upon how the experience of Peru might apply to Canada. We can't make direct comparisons, for the cases are very different. The TRC of Peru, as with most TRCs, have a very different trajectory than that sought by Canada. The Peruvian Truth Commission emerged out of an authoritarian regime and an internal armed conflict, marking a transition towards a new democratic government, followed by a Truth Commission, followed by the publication of a final report, a formal state apology, and the establishment of a list of reparations with ongoing work towards reconciliation. Despite the different trajectory, we might draw some points of observation and some questions. If we look back at the three tensions briefly outlined, the first being Truth Commissions as indispensable yet in marking transition and establishing truth, yet insufficient, it raises the question of what is the transition in Canada and what are the expectations being built up by having a Truth Commission. In the second case, the second tension, which of the uses of truth are being employed, one hopes that it is truth as a wedge rather than truth as a political formula that is being invoked. What then will be the new spaces that this wedge will open? It is in this final tension, reconciling with the past, that perhaps the Canadian Truth Commission can borrow from Peru. The conflict over public space, the dissonance between macro and micro narratives, and the public hearings all indicate that though it has only been 5 years in Peru since they had a Truth Commission, the period of armed conflict has not been forgotten, and nor has it been silenced. The work of the Peruvian Truth Commission in particular, the holding of public hearings, is perhaps a useful model for establishing the kind of truth-telling forum that we could envision in Canada. For Peru, it cannot be underestimated the importance of having created a time and a space where the state listened to the harms committed to individuals and to communities. It was the first time for some of those who testified that they had ever encountered a representative of the state outside of a military man. This encounter served to include individuals in the nation and also to make the nation listen, even if fleetingly. These public hearings might serve as a kind of model for other countries of recounting and reconciling with the past, an example of telling the paths and of listening of these paths, pasts, by fellow citizens and by the state. Thank you very much.